Welcome back to another episode of Venture Unlocked, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of the business of venture capital. I'm your host, Samir Kaji, and on this episode, we are pleased to be joined by Adam Bain of O1 Advisors, a San Francisco-based firm with nearly $1 billion under management. Adam and his partners have taken a very different approach to the venture model. Drawing from their experiences as operators, Adam was COO at Twitter, and along with his partner Dick Costolo, helped the company scale from zero to $1 billion in revenues as fast as any company. During this time, they were able to spend a significant amount of time with Bill Campbell, the legendary CEO coach who helped inspire the foundation for O1 Advisors. Since founding the firm in 2018, they have a uniquely focused approach to venture coaching, and unlike other Series B and later VCs, they do not take board seats. We went through the why of this model, along with topics such as the transition from operating to investing, and the future of potentially using models to determine founder archetypes. If you're a venture investor, then I'm sure you already know about Sidecar, the go-to platform for emerging VCs to manage their SPVs and funds. Sidecar is on a mission to make private markets more accessible, transparent, and liquid by standardizing how investment vehicles are created and executed. Their powerful and robust software allows VCs to launch SPVs and funds instantaneously, track funding in real time, and offer hassle-free opportunities for early liquidity. Whether you're syndicating your first or 50th deal, Sidecar acts as your silent operating partner, handling all back office functions in a single place. Sidecar always has your back so that you'd never have to worry about chasing subscription documents, loss wires, or late K-1s. Sidecar's responsive and proactive customer support team is there to assist you, helping you build trust with your investors and tackling the challenges of building your firm. To learn more, visit sidecar.io/venture unlocked.
Samir Kaji is the CEO and co-founder of Allocate. Allocate and Venture Unlocked are independent of each other. Any statements or references made by Samir or his guests regarding third parties, investments, or securities are solely their views and opinions and are not intended as investment advice or an endorsement of such parties or securities by Samir, his guests, or Allocate. Allocate or its clients may maintain relationships with or investment positions in guests, third parties, or securities mentioned in this podcast. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
Adam, good seeing you, man. Thanks for being on the show.
Samira, thanks. And hello to everybody listening to Venture Unlocked.
We're here in December, right before Christmas here. There's actually a lot to talk about, but the thing that I really want to distill down to is the firm itself, your journey. So maybe talk a little bit about your journey going into tech, and then ultimately the why of why did you start the firm in 2018, 19?
We started the firm in 2018, just as I was leaving Twitter. So I spent almost 7 years at Twitter as the chief revenue officer and chief operating officer. I came in 2010. To Twitter when it was less than 100 people, one office location in San Francisco, and zero in revenue, and basically took the company from zero to $1 billion in revenue, and then $1 billion to $2 billion in revenue, faster than almost any other consumer internet company. We took Twitter public in 2013, ran a public company for a bit, and then I left after about 7 years on great terms with everybody. I just basically got bored of social media and bored of advertising and was looking for like something else so that I can continue learning other categories beyond social and beyond advertising business models. And it dawned on me that one awesome way to do that would be advising CEOs. And so in 2018, started doing a bunch of advising work and then called our ex-CEO of Twitter, Dick, and said, "This is amazing. I'm learning all kinds of stuff. We should go do this together." And so we started doing this in 2018 together, just with our own capital first, basically did a hybrid investing and also advising with CEOs. And so our first initial deals were companies like Airtable, Carta, TripActions, Opendoor, which became monster businesses. And we were like, oh, this is like venture, super easy. And so we raised our first institutional capital in 2019. We've raised now about $1 billion of capital in just about 4 years. 3 weeks ago, we announced our Fund 3, which is a $395 million fund. And it's Dick and myself. And then we just brought in David Fisher. David was the chief revenue officer at Facebook for a very long time. And before that, Google. So I think we're like the only venture firm now that can honestly claim the partners have taken companies from zero, because Fisher came in when Facebook was just about zero as well. So zero in revenue to $123 billion of yearly revenue. Although Fisher is about $121 billion of that in Facebook versus us, and created about almost $1 trillion of market cap from the C-suite.
It's amazing. So one of the things that, you know, I always track is the number of funds that come, or number of firms that come every single year. And we saw this steady stream of new VC firms. And I think around 2018, 19, there were so many new firms that have been formed over the past decade. A lot of LPs ask the question, why does the world need another venture firm? And what's different about what you're doing? And there's actually a lot different. And we'll go into each one of those components during the course of this conversation. But you mentioned this concept of advisory and CEO advisory. And one of the things that I know heavily influenced how you and Dick were thinking about the firm was your experience with Bill Campbell, who, of course, legendary, the late, great Bill Campbell. But tell us about how his influence helped you think about the strategy of the firm when you started it.
Well, Bill is a legend here in the Valley. He was Eric, Larry, and Sergey's coach at Google. He was Steve Jobs' coach and very close friend at Apple. He was Jeff Bezos' first coach at Amazon. And what made Bill amazing is he was a ex-operator, first and foremost. He was, I think, a VP of marketing at Apple originally, and then he was the CEO of Claris, CEO of Go, and CEO of Intuit, and eventually chair, I believe, at Intuit. He was probably like the greatest non-technical Silicon Valley person ever. So I got to Twitter in 2010, and the Benchmark folks who were investors in Twitter had brought him in to Twitter to help coach some of us. So I would start meeting. I was meeting with Bill once a week or once every 2 weeks, starting in 2010. And I, you know, my background was in the sports business, and I was brought in to open up the ads business for Twitter. And Bill was a massive sports fan, and actually had worked before Apple. Had actually worked in the ad business. Not many people know that. So we instantly connected. He was just absolutely amazing. He's super impactful on my life. He was incredible in terms of the coaching and advice that he gave me personally and gave Twitter overall. Every great exec in Silicon Valley has these types of people around them, these coaches, these advisors. And when we were thinking about launching something in the venture side of the world, we were like, you know, VC, for most people, the C is capital. But our idea was, what if VC meant more venture coaching? And so we decided to take a slightly different idea, which was, could we basically become as important to the, I mean, certainly we're coming with capital, but could we become important to the founders and the CEOs as coaches as much as we were capital?
Since many people have probably read the book, at least the listeners that we have, Trillion Dollar Coach, and of course, Bill, you know, coming from being a football coach to now coaching executives, tell us what stuck so much with you in terms of the things that he helped with. So, you think about this concept of value add. Some of that is, over the years, feels like it's been bastardized to a point where it's, you know, these memes and things like that. But tell us why he was so impactful to you as an operator and to Dick as an operator that helped you then use that as a way to inform your strategy.
I learned so much from Bill. But Bill was obsessed with how you get the best idea out of a room. And we've all been in a room before where people either are throwing out ideas or the room is chilled out and there's not enough dialogue happening. And the amazing thing about Bill is he was so focused on how to actually generate the best ideas. And to him, the best idea won. So he wasn't focused on consensus. To him, he felt like groupthink led to inferior decisions. So his whole mentality, especially with getting people together, was how do you get great ideas out in the open? He was all about kind of embracing dissenting opinions, leaning into hard problems. You know, to him, experiences didn't matter. The ideas mattered. And so I watched him in a bunch of meetings where he was able to pull stuff out of people. He actually wasn't on the Twitter board, but he was in the Twitter board meetings, which was also amazing. It was interesting to watch in the board meeting because when it came to Bill talking, Bill would actually pass the ball to somebody else. Maybe somebody else in the meeting who wasn't talking enough. And he'd go around the room and say, you know, hey, Adam, what do you think about that? And put you on the spot. But it was an attempt to pull some of the, you know, great ideas out in the open. The other thing I saw him do just around ideas is, you know, if you did, there were situations where two people disagreed and vehemently disagreed. And Bill did this thing where it was all about getting those two people who vehemently disagreed and saying, "Go, fine, you two people go out, go figure out a solution, and then come back to the team and tell us where you got to." So I learned a ton about getting ideas out in the open and getting ideas out in how great ideas are generated. You know, and it kind of mapped to his view of management and leadership. His big idea ultimately was, yes, your job is to break ties. And there are a bunch of times when the organization can't ultimately decide what to do. And that ultimately, you know, as a leader, you come in to break ties. But also a good measure of the organization is how many times you have to come in and break those ties. You know, can you get the organization to ultimately break ties on their own without the leader constantly being, you know, needing to jump in and breaking ties? He had a really crystal clear vision of what a leader was. He made a distinction between leadership and management, or leaders and managers. In his mind, leaders didn't make all the decisions. The job of the leader was to ask the right questions, you know, to get the team to inspire imaginations and get the team to dream big. And ultimately, the second job was to create an environment for them to do the best work of their lives. So he had this line about, you know, the title makes you a manager, but the people will decide if you're a leader. His view was you earned leadership from your people. Leadership is something that the people bestow on you. And it maps into, you know, it maps into these stories that he used to tell. The amazing thing about Bill's style was half the time he was swearing at you, and the other half he was telling stories. And he was telling stories about stuff that he had experienced in his operating background, and they were incredible because they weren't stories that you were able to get from anybody else. Like, we had our board was incredible at Twitter. Originally in 2010, it wasn't filled with operators, except Bill would fill in the gaps. So you would go ask a question of people around the table and you'd get awesome answers back. Bill's answers were answers in the form of stories. You know, thinking about ideas and decisions and stuff like that. You know, Bill used to tell this story about he had just gotten to Claris as the CEO of Claris. And he was going into CEO mode, you know, the first like 6 weeks. And he had an exec named Donna Dubinsky, who comes to him after the first six weeks and says, "Hey, Bill, if you're going to make all the decisions, then like all of us are going to go back to Apple. You know, you hired us because we know what we're doing. Let us to our jobs." And so part of his view was, how do you actually enable the teams to operate effectively and be the best versions of themselves? And again, the role of the manager and the leader is to step in and course correct if they need it.
You mentioned something I hadn't heard before, and that's the concept of venture coaching versus venture capitalism. And it does make sense given that how you've constructed your model of not taking board seats. Bill, as you mentioned, was not on the board of Twitter, but presumably had a influence that was equal or probably even greater in some cases than the rest of the board members. Maybe we can distill down to, how does this actually work? Because not taking a board seat is fairly antithetical to venture firms, maybe outside of seed. How does that work from an operating standpoint in terms of how you're helping companies?
We do a couple things that are maybe antithetical to what most VCs do. Not taking board seats, that was a total Bill Campbellism. We tried to get Bill on the Twitter board back in 2010. And he turned around and said, "I'm not going to serve on the board because you're going to end up telling me more and I'll be more helpful to you if I'm not on the board. And sure enough, it absolutely became true. Bill was the call before the board if there was good news or bad news. That stuck with me. And when we started O1, part of the idea was, how could we be that first call if there's good news or bad news? How do we almost fly above the board? There is absolutely a case when you join a board, you by nature have to sit partly across the table from the CEO. And we like to sit on the same, closer at least on the same side. You know, the logical question then is, like, from a governance standpoint or from a, you know, does it bias your view? And actually, no. I mean, the thing about being a close advisor to the CEO is you actually are able to be more frank with the CEO. You're able to spot questions and problems and issues maybe in a different way and speak in a more unfettered way with the CEO, give them truth ultimately. So primarily our not taking board seats is that we are still getting obviously all the board materials, and we are sitting in on board meetings to give feedback to the CEO on probably how to run a more effective board meeting. But our hope is we know more about what's going on at our companies than the boards do themselves. I'll give you one other thing though is, in 2018, we started just dissecting venture capital. How does it work? And, you know, we talked to a bunch of our friends who are massive institutional VCs. And it dawned on us that one of the problems with venture capital is in linear scale, which is to keep scaling. Ultimately, when you take board seats, you therefore need to add more and more and more partners. Right, as you continue to scale out the size of the firm or the capital under management, et cetera. And so it leads to this linear scaling of people. And that at times that's when things seem, you know, to go wrong in venture capital. And so the one advantage for us is it is a massive free up on our time, and it allows us to scale a little bit more effectively. So not taking board seats is one of, I'd say there's like two or three other things that we do that's a little bit different.
Let's go into, you know, some of those things in a second, but I want to come back to this whole concept of not taking a board seat, because many of the firms that you did consult with maybe before starting the firm, they all take board seats. Part of that is, you're right, it's around controlling some level of governance at the board level, making, you know, having the ability to make certain decisions. LPs often, you know, ask the question, are you taking board seats as a part of your own firm and fund governance? How did LPs, you know, when you were raising with this kind of model of, we're not taking board seats, we're simply being the coach, we will get better information, what were some of the questions that came up, and how did you think about answering those?
Well, so one is when we do lead in price and there is a board seat that comes with the round, we don't abandon the board seat, right? So what we do is we work with the CEO to take that seat and find an independent operator, so somebody from our network ultimately, that will sit in the seat. And so the positioning to the founder is like, this is a plus plus. You get us and all the things that we're able to do. And in addition, we also are going to bring a really interesting, experienced operator. Now, you obviously need to approve that person as well, but bring a really amazing operator to sit in that seat, so you will get incredible guidance, not just from us, but also from a great operator. The second thing is, on the governance standpoint, there's one, it all seems like it makes sense on paper, but here's the truth. Most VCs are bouncing from boardroom to boardroom to boardroom. And so from a time perspective, they don't have a lot of time to get into the actual details of what's going on at the company. What we do is we team our board approach also with the idea that we are super concentrated in the amount of companies that we invest out of the fund. And so in each fund, there's about 15 to 20 companies that we invest per fund. And so that's different, as you know, than a traditional Silicon Valley firm of, you know, 50 to 80 companies in a fund. By being more concentrated, our view is that we can go deeper with companies, and we can also spot opportunities, but also problems, hopefully faster and better than what you might otherwise see. And we've seen it already. Like we've got examples of boards who, you know, we are almost like the early warning signal. We'll come to the board and say, hey, you know, we see a pretty massive problem. And in the bunch of times that we've done that, the boards have said, we don't see it yet. And then sure enough, a couple quarters later, it becomes more obvious. I think it's just hard. It's hard for them because they are, you know, in so many board meetings doing so much. And by not being, you know, spread too thin, we feel like we can go deeper.
So the merits that you're articulating, of course, Bill Campbell did this really, really well in terms of helping these companies grow and scale probably better than the vast majority of the VCs that were in these different companies. But are there situations where you think, because in some ways the argument is like, why does any VC take a board seat? Do you really need to do it?
It definitely is important. Governance is absolutely important. Having a sounding board, both for the CEO and the management team and also the employee base, there are massively important roles and responsibilities the boards play. Our view is to say there can't be everybody in Silicon Valley doing this because then it wouldn't work. But if there are folks like us where it's unique and different, then it basically works together with the institutional board that's in place.
That makes total sense. And maybe shifting a little bit to some of the other things that you might do that are not traditional or conventional. And, you know, we talked about the number of companies you do taking, and also thinking about leading rounds versus not leading rounds. So maybe we look at portfolio construction. The common convention is 25, 30 companies. That gives you enough to get those outliers. Tell us a little bit about how you think about portfolio construction, why you arrived at what you did.
Okay, so first off, we aren't a Series Seed or Pre-Seed or Early A fund where you see most of the great funds in Silicon Valley kind of live in. I think what those people do are amazing. I can't do that at all, where you meet with a founder and then where there's nothing built, but you instantly know it in your gut and soul that this person is going to be great. And the thing that they're building, even though there's not much there, is going to be world changing. Like I wish I could do that, but I can't. And and neither can Dick and neither could David Fisher. We're pretty realistic about who we are. We are at scale operators. We've come into situations where the product has been built and it's been time then to take the product from being a great product to being an amazing business or amazing company. And that's the situation we all found ourselves in each one of our operating experiences, operating roles. For us, that means usually a Series B, sometimes a late A, is when the company has found product market fit, the bolts are coming off the rocket ship in a good way, the founder's having great kind of problems, the problems we all wish for in business. And at that point, there's usually great investors already on the cap table. So in some ways, the last thing the founder needs is yet another investor. And instead, since it's about to go through a pretty interesting scaling exercise, they usually want people who have been there, done it before. And that's why for us, the stage where we invest in kind of matches our background. Weirdly, there's not a ton of at-scale operators in venture, like true at-scale operators. There's certainly not a lot hanging around in Series B. In fact, the later you go in terms of stage in venture, the less operating experience you seem to see, right? And the reason for that is because, you know, the underwriting becomes a little bit more less about the intuition about the founder and the product and more about facts. But weirdly, that's actually precisely where the operating experience becomes really valuable, right? Is in this operating centric or operating intensive moment at the company. So the one difference is we come in usually at Series B. You know, our thesis to our LPs is pretty simple, which is we don't want to take any product market fit risk. What we're seeking is execution risk. And we believe as former operators that we really understand execution risk or operating risk better than anybody because we've lived it. And that if we do our job right, we can understand that risk better than anyone, underwrite that risk, that operating risk better than anyone, and then really help the founders put the thumb on the scale to mitigate that operating risk.
When you look at these, some of these companies, right? So you're doing this small select group of companies. So you're not doing 20 investments per year. You're looking at these companies that have crossed the chasm of clearly they have a product that the market needs and is willing to pay for. You have a team in place that might have been in place for now 3, 4, 5 years, depending on when you're coming in. But still, there's a lot that still needs to be done for this to be a venture-style exit. And, you know, the old triangle of, you know, it's people, it's product, and it's market, right? So size of marketing, people have different opinions on which one's important. As you think about it at that stage, while there is some traction, you're taking execution risk, which does matter when it comes to the people, the management team. How do you index these different parts of like the analysis to be able to make a decision on, hey, this is the right product, this is the right market, but more importantly, it's the right team to do this?
So I'll give you two parts of the answer. The first one is just the technical part, which is since all of us really came into our companies and help inflect revenue. And at Series B, it really is when revenue, you've got a little bit of revenue and it's really starting to inflect. And this is the beginnings of really repeatable revenue. One area that we heavily diligence, heavily weight, and heavily focus on is, I'm assuming there's product market fit, we really are able to go in and dig deep into the revenue stream of a company. And part of the thing that we do when we underwrite is we really get into the weeds on how revenue is generated. And then the other question is, what can we do to help put the finger on the thumb on the scale? Are there customers that we can introduce in mass? Can we refactor the go-to-market or the sales team? Can we help on hiring? A big thing for us and a place where we truly are, we believe different is really on this go-to-market activity. And it's just based on, again, our backgrounds for doing this and also knowing that this is really what a bunch of CEOs need at this phase is, you know, how do I begin to inflect revenue? The second part is CEO EQ and IQ is still massively important at this phase. And we got obsessed with this question, which is how do you actually understand talent? Again, starting in 2018, we started going around and realizing that the selection part of all the S's of venture, you know, seeing, selecting, et cetera. On the selecting side, the question that we kept going around to folks and asking is like, well, how do you know? How do you know? Like, that was the question. When you see somebody, how do you know? How do you know that this is the person? How do you know this is the company? And I was expecting an algorithm. I was expecting a rubric. I was expecting like science. And surprisingly, a lot of the answers came back are very similar to like the old Moneyball book where, you know, the scouts were evaluating talent. We started wondering if there was alternative ways to begin to get data in. About a year ago, we met an incredible person to help us answer this question. His name is Jay Harrison, Dr. Jay Harrison. He spent 16 years in professional hockey, 11 of them in the NHL. He's a four-time Canadian national team player. He spent all this time in the NHL and then leaves the NHL and goes to get his PhD in cognitive psychology. It's like a true N of one. Like, I can count on one finger the amount of NHL players who then go out and get a PhD in cognitive psychology. And his focus was, how do I take this psychology degree and apply it back to the world sports initially? To answer this question around understanding leadership and management in sports. And so his first version of his company is he actually built a way to help evaluate and analyze talent for sports teams who were going to the draft. And about a decade ago, two decades ago now, there used to be this thing called the Wunderlich test that NHL teams, for example, would give draftees, quarterbacks primarily, and it would be an evaluation not just of the athletic piece, but an evaluation of the mind, the study of the mind. You know, the classic Wunderlich test, A-B test, was Peyton Manning and Ryan Leaf, who came out at the same time, and there was a Wunderlich test that was given to both of them, and Peyton scored off the charts, and Ryan didn't do so well, and it certainly played out that way, so it ended up being somewhat predictive. Anyway, we meet Jay, and he's doing this for NHL teams and MLB teams and some NFL teams and the like. He's also doing it for the Navy SEALs, I believe, or some of the special ops folks. So we got really interested in this. We're like, I wonder if you could take this evaluation and not just push it towards sports, but could it work for CEOs? And could it work for tech CEOs? Could it work for startup tech CEOs? And so we're really early in our work with Jay, but we've begun to develop a bit of work that we do with the CEO after we invest. So we invest in the company, and then we introduce the CEO to Dr. Jay. And Jay takes the CEO through some work to help basically understand their strengths and weaknesses. And then that allows us to shape our own services work at the firm around the needs that, you know, we've surfaced. So it's early, but it's super interesting in terms of, you know, what we're learning from that so far.
Yeah, it's like this combination of some of the personality tests alongside maybe the Wunderlich test. And it helps determine exactly, because at the end of the day, VC and then coaching a CEO is not going to be the same CEO to CEO. Everyone is a unique person. I know it's early so far, but have you found anything, I guess, thematically that you've learned through the progress so far that has helped instruct that service model? And I love the word service model for the CEOs.
Yes, 100%. It basically, in the short amount of time that we've been doing it, it helps derive a very quick picture and almost like an archetype of who the founder is. And it leads to the very next question of like, what surrounding help do they need? When we think about surrounding the founder then with additional talent at the C level, we're using this as a roadmap. If you find that the founder is a certain type of leader but has the following gaps, part of what we're able to do is say, great, now we understand this really well, and the founder, by the way, never realized this as well, that we can work together to kind of map out with some of the remaining hires on the exec team, how do you actually fill in some of the gaps? It's worked really effectively. Probably the biggest learning, though, is there's not one way to be successful. And we think about these as archetypes, but not as like we will only invest in this type of founder. Instead, it's, you know, just understand, since there are multiple ways to be successful, let's try to understand who that person is, what drives them, and then what are the ways that we can surround them with support.
It's such an interesting discussion. And one of the things that, even you're doing this with CEOs, a lot of people that are listening to this show are LPs, and they're looking around and they see 4,000 active plus US VCs, maybe 7,000 when you look globally, and trying to figure out, at the end of the day, the product that you're providing, just the tangible product is capital, but there's so much more associated with being able to do that selection, seeing in its brand and its, you know, what you're doing for founders over time that starts to compound. And there isn't a good sort of test right now to determine, like, is a VC going to be successful and have a high probability of outsized returns? And one of the things that you and I think I talked about maybe a month ago around this is, are there certain traits that you've learned that are really important that have worked for you as a VC? And maybe thinking about archetypes, we have seen more operators turn VCs. It's not always an easy transition.
So it's not. Although you and I have talked about this too. The amazing thing is, it's, again, there's no one way to be successful. Probably some of the best of the best, the Hall of Fame VCs have actually not been operators. By the way, an interesting job, if you go look at it, some of the best were journalists in a former life. And actually that, when you think about that, that opened my eyes a little bit to what does a great VC do? Because in journalism, you basically go out and you sit with you interview somebody, you sit with a person that you're focused on, and you basically try and crawl into their head and look at the world through their eyes, and you see the world as they see it. And then you take a step back after spending time with the subject and you go, okay, now I'm out of their head. Did that make sense? What resonates? What doesn't resonate? Is that how the world is going to play out? Or is there a different point of view? There's actually a lot of strength that, at least the core foundation of what journalists do, they're very similar to what VCs do. You're trying to understand the story and understand the subjects in the story and trying to construct a view of how the world actually looks. But this idea of operators and investors, I'll give you maybe like where it's the same and then where it's really different. I'll start maybe with where it's different. In operating, what's awesome about it is there's about 1,000 actions that you can take at any one moment where you're able to evolve. And the great thing usually in operating is any decision that you make can always be innovated on. And it's not usually just one thing, but it's a series of things that usually add up to, you know, ultimately outcomes. So it's not just hiring. It's not just launching products. It's not just convincing customers of things. It's a million of those things that add up to whether or not a company is successful. You know, my view of operating at times is it's very muscular. It's very quick twitch at times. And if anything, using a sailing analogy, like you ultimately can sail from one place to the other, but you're constantly tacking, you're constantly navigating, you're constantly maneuvering. Investing, on the other hand, seems quite different in that there's not 1,000 evolutions you can take. There's basically at least, or there's one important one, which is you're writing the check. And then for a large part, you're along for the ride. So there are a lot of operators turn investors who bug out because they just can't deal with that. So that's been different. I'll tell you where it's the same, and it's not usually the one that people say. You know, we usually when I started investing, people would say to me, "Oh, you know, it's really going to bug you that you're not going to be able to like have your hands on the steering wheel." And it's true when you're investing, you're not driving the car, and any VC that tries to drive a car is making a pretty big mistake. You don't have the wheel. Instead, the trick is giving the right coaching and advice, maybe, you know, pulling up the map so the founder can get their bearings, and influencing and nudging the wheel, but not taking the wheel, right? And so to me, that's actually surprisingly similar to large scale management, which is to say, if you have thousands of people working for you, or in David's case, tens of thousands of people that are working for you, you just can't take the wheel and drive. In some ways, it's like being a great investor, which is you're influencing and you're nudging the organization. But if you're there trying to drive at a massive organization, then it's kind of too late. So I think you're there for coaching advice. You're pulling up the map so the organization has their bearings. You know, it is surprisingly similar to running a large scale organization.
I like the fact that you brought up journalism. Of course, everyone knows that, or a lot of people know, I think, that one of the best VCs of all time, Mike Moritz, was a journalist before he started, right? People can come from different walks of life. You know, we mentioned Bill Campbell coming from the football, and I don't think he got into business until his late 30s, early 40s.
That's right. Bill was a football coach. We all called him coach, partly because he was a football coach. And also because obviously he was the coach.
Part of like this thing is like you're going through this continuous learning journey when you make these transitions. If you kind of look back, because there are a lot of folks that, you know, we talked to, there are operators that were thinking about getting into VC. Of course, it was much easier to get into VC in 2019, 20, and 21, where the money was flowing almost endlessly without any sort of end in sight. But if you look back, what did you get the most right about the transition? What did you get the most wrong?
We got into VC for one simple reason, which is I left my job because I got bored. And as a public company exec, I woke up on January 1st, the year I left, and I realized that I was so curious about everything, yet I felt like I wasn't learning. And I feel like in any job, in any operating job especially, you have a pendulum that swings back and forth between learning and doing. Too much learning, you're in over your head. Too much doing, you're bored. And so the magic is to keep it balanced. And I felt like I had swung the pendulum too far into doing and not enough into learning. I wasn't challenged. I got, and the same reason Dick got into this, and then when we started talking to David Fisher, and he was like, that's what I want, which is the learning piece of it. And this is a job where, holy moly, you go to school every single day. You get to sit with some of the most interesting people in the world that are tackling incredible problems. Like a journalist, you're basically crawling into their world point of view and seeing the world through their eyes. By nature, it's an optimistic point of view. They're doing something optimistically to improve and change reality. And that's super exciting and super invigorating to do that. And then you're going and stepping back out and saying, wait, what did I hear? Does that make sense? And more importantly, let me go learn about this thing that this person is doing, this category, the competitors, the whole gamut. And so you go around and interview all kinds of people around it. You're often doing work, you know, months and months and months in advance of any kind of deal, some case years in advance. So the intellectual piece of this is a 10 out of 10. I can't imagine ever getting bored in this job because it's just an incredible cornucopia of like just learning. At the same time, the business of VC is kind of interesting. I think the brand like ranking of venture funds has never been so uncertain as it is right now. It just seems like there is a sea of same out there right now, and that people have made decisions that ultimately the answer to a bunch of folks is just scale. That in their mind, the way that they ultimately can differentiate is scale. And I just don't believe that scale is the sole differentiator. And that's partly from like, we were never on all of the brands that I've ever worked at, we were never the biggest. We always had something else going for them. So we always lived with a chip on our shoulder at each operating gig. And I feel like that exists very much right now in venture, in the business of venture.
Since we're talking about the business of venture capital, you're 6 years in, of which the first few years at O1, the market was absolutely on fire in terms of the abundance of capital, both for VC funds and entrepreneurs. Things changed materially at the beginning of 2022. And so you've seen a cycle very early in the franchise. I'd be curious to hear how you've navigated this and what you've learned being on this side of the table and deploying to entrepreneurs. What is informing the conversations with those founders today?
I'll tell you, today, it really is like our Super Bowl moment right now. Because as you described, there were a bunch of people that plopped right down in Series B land with us. And it meant things were very crazy for a short amount of time, but it was pretty wild what was happening out there. Since we only do a small amount of deals in general, we just did less. We just sat on our hands for most of it. What's happened now is all those people that kind of hung out in late A or early Series B land have left. Weirdly, they have gone upstream into seed, which is hard for me to understand what's actually going on there. But it's actually, you can see it in valuation and prices. There's some data that we were just looking at last month that showed, you know, Series B valuations are down like 35% versus 2021. Series A prices are down only about 5%, I believe. But seed prices are up 55%. So it's like, oh my gosh, what's going on there? So we feel like when people left this category, that it has really become our moment. And not just because we're the kind of only focused folks in the category, but because of what we do. And so if anything, the call for our help and work that we do has gotten stronger. It's basically like our own product market fit, if you will, for our firm has gotten stronger through this period. And actually what's been neat is I'd say for the year, it's been pretty slow for 2023. However, I'd say the last 6 weeks, we've seen an absolute onslaught of companies. And this is stuff that we've been working now for like 2 years, 3 years, of companies that we've been like honing and waiting and getting ready for this moment. Boy, we're pretty excited actually about what how everything is playing out right now. Obviously, there's a macro to keep in mind, but also knowing that these fund bets are 7 to 10 year timeline bets. Some of the most meaningful companies were created in the last downturn, and I think there are a bunch that are going to be created in this one as well.
Yeah, I share your excitement, and I do think at the Series B level especially, because not only are the valuations down, but you have this pretty big logjam of companies that have gotten seed and Series A funding that in order to raise Series B, like the one benefit of being a downstream investor is you need more traction, you need more fundamentals. And so it's like this intersection between lower valuations and stronger companies, probably the best thing, obviously, you know, for folks like yourself.
We're early enough for there still to be a pretty massive upside, but late enough where we're not taking, you know, product market fit risk. So it's this really awesome place to be.
That's great. And it's been great to see. I still remember coming into the office back in, I think, 2019 at the beginning and seeing the growth of it. Really appreciate you coming on today. The really great insights and a fun conversation. Look forward to doing this again sometime.
Awesome. Thank you, Samir.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of Venture Unlocked. We really hope you enjoyed it. To learn more about Adam, be sure to go to ventureunlocked.substack.com, where you'll find detailed notes of the show and a listing of past episodes. You'll also find us on Apple or Spotify, where you can subscribe to get all of the latest shows as soon as they're released.